Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, listening to Author to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you most want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you most want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA, you can go to pnwa.org. And as a matter of fact, if you are a PNWA member or planning to become one, I will be teaching a class for them at their lovely Writer's Cottage in Snoqualmie, Washington, in a three-part series, one class in January, two in February. So if you're looking for a little tune-up, want a class on memoir, very popular genre these days, I must say, and one I quite enjoy, you can check that out. I believe that'll be going out relatively soon, so look for that in your inbox if you're a member of the PNWA. Tonight, if you're in Seattle, or the Seattle area, I'll be teaching part three of the Writing as a Spiritual Practice at East West Books in the Ravenna District. It is part three, but it doesn't matter if you miss parts one and two. You can come tonight and you will not really miss a beat. We're just going to keep on talking about writing as a spiritual practice, and I'll be resuming my author's roundtable there at East West Books the first week in, first Thursday in January. I think that's the 6th, maybe. And as always, you know, I don't talk a lot on this show about how to write. I don't usually get into the craft with the authors. As you may have noticed, I talk mostly about why we write and how important it is. And Write Within Yourself, An Author's Companion, my collection of essays, is exactly that kind of a book. It's a why we write book, and you can pick that up wherever fine books are sold. You know, I have an opinion, a theory, and it's mine, and here it is. It's that all stories, in one way or another, are about death, or about what we think death means. And I really think it doesn't matter whether you're writing literary fiction or suspense or mystery or even romance or science fiction. The question of what death is or isn't, in my opinion, hovers over every story told in some fashion or another, which is why I'm so glad to have today's guests on the show. Douglas Bauer has written, just published relatively recently, What Happens Next? Matters of Life and Death. This is a lovely collection of autobiographical essays and stories about, well, life and death. And that's what we're going to talk about today, as soon as I get him on the show. Doug, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
Well, it's my pleasure to have you. What Happens Next is an interesting collection, just to sort of give folks an outline of what it is. You describe it as a series of essays, but it's really almost a kind of mini memoir in, I can't even know if I can call them essays. They're really kind of like stories. They're certainly narrative. Maybe you could do a better job of describing what it is you've written here.
Well, I would agree with everything you say. The only distinction I would make, Bill, is everything is factual. It's not invented, and so in that sense,
no.
It separates themselves from the idea of stories. But the book, as I sort of had ambition for it, was to, in a way, model it structurally after the genre of a novel and stories or a series of connected stories. Which is a way of narrative that I have always been very partial to as a reader, and when I was thinking of when I was thinking of this book, that narrative structure suggested itself to me, and so I just followed it.
You know what? One of my favorite books of works of nonfiction, and I've talked about it some on this show. And it's a model that I don't see used very much, and I think I'm going to have to try it myself at some point. And I thought of it when I read What Happens Next, is A Movable Feast by Ernest Hemingway, where it's a connected series of autobiographical stories. I mean, they're stories. They're not, I mean, they're nonfiction stories, but they're stories.
Right.
But they are connected.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's an interesting comparison. I'm obviously flattered to have it. But yes, you're right. It seems to me it's very close to the same structural model we're talking about.
Well, and so this book, Matters of Life and Death, and it came about because of an unusual kind of synchronicity of what was going on in your life with both your own health and the passing of your mother at a rather ripe old age, as we say. And it got you thinking about this whole of maybe what happens next and just what life is.
Exactly so. The coincidence you're referring to is that, you know, I'm in my early 60s, and as happens to the body at a certain age, things begin to not fail necessarily, but sort of what I call the ordinary maladies of age. And I was having just a kind of series of those, including the need to have cataract surgery. And my mother, who, as you suggest, was, you know, she was then 86, was quite ill, but not in any way that we thought, my brother and I thought, was mortal. And as it happened, the very morning and the very hour I was having my very, very minor surgery, she in a hospital half a continent away in Iowa died. And the coincidence of my being under anesthesia and her dying at the very same hour got me, it just seemed like a coincidence and a metaphor too large to ignore.
Right. You know, it's funny, Doug, because you're also a novelist. You've written, you're the author of three novels, Dexterity, The Very Air, and The Book of Famous Iowans. So, and fiction writers, coincidence is a tool, and it's a dangerous one sometimes, of course. You don't want to overuse it, but it's a great tool for the fiction writer. And yet, when it comes up in our life, and I've had some incredible coincidences in my life, and when I have them, I think, could I ever render this believably in fiction, or would it seem impossible? Would it seem unbelievable?
Yeah.
Did any of that kind of go through? Did the fiction? I mean, it's hard, but once you become a writer, you process everything in that way. Maybe you don't. I do anyway.
No. I it's an interesting point, and I think it does, in a way, kind of point to the difference in the genre, the different demands, the different opportunities between fiction and nonfiction. That what you're suggesting about the way you can use coincidence in nonfiction, just because we're all familiar with coincidences in real life, runs the risk of seeming very unlikely at best if you try to make the same thing happen fictionally. I just finished my teaching semester where I teach at Bennington in Vermont, and I was teaching a course, one of my favorite courses in Dickens. And, you know, of course, he is both celebrated and denounced for his coincidences. And my class and I had a lot of great conversations about how he gets away with it or does not.
Right. And but life will hand you coincidences. And now, as a human being, then you have to. And I think I tend to deal with life like there's nothing is accidental. That's sort of my. It's always been my approach. And it always feels to me as if something is trying to get my attention is being called for. Now, that's up to me to interpret it, but that seems to be what happened to you at that moment.
It's exactly what happened to me. Exactly so. And as I say, you know, I lived with it just kind of absorbing, you know, just the news of her death, first of all, and then just nagged by what I did take, and I'm not as prone to that kind of thinking as it sounds as if you are, but this one I can't imagine anybody ignoring this, the one I am referring to, and the one that I then used for this book.
Yeah. Well, you used it very well, and there was a interesting moment where you. This is the kind of language you use all the time, but it always gets my attention, which is you were talking about your heart, because one of the challenges, you had your eyes, but your heart was also giving you some information about itself. And so you were
calling
attention, but you were always, it was certainly doing that. And this is the language we use. We say I and my heart. And we often make that distinction between ourselves and then our body.
Yes.
And so that is kind of an interesting existential question. Is that simply a linguistic trick? I tend to think not. Or is there a sense of like there's me and then there's this thing that I'm inhabiting? Do you ever have that sense?
Well, I certainly did as I began to think about the book. This book caused me or forced me or allowed me to think in those terms in a way that I'd never had. But and I think, too, it's another issue of as we age and the way in which we feel, that our bodies have a kind of an independent entity that's separate from what we think of as I. And
right.
It's almost as though, as I often think about it, the two have been, if we're lucky in life, the two have been kind of cooperating for most of
right.
our lives. And then there comes a time in a certain age where you start to feel that you're in competition with your body. The body begins to have the upper hand, and there's only so much you can do about it. And, when we're young, we have this idea that we are in control of it. And after a while, it becomes clear that that's not the case.
Yeah, I think as I've gotten older, and I'm a few years younger than you, but as I've gotten older, I mean, I can remember when I was a young man, I was very athletic. My body really, like a dog, wanted to run. It was like, please. Run me, get me out there. And then as I ran in my middle years, it was an agreement we reached. It's, yes, I will run. If you want me to, we will go out there and do that, right?
Exactly.
But as I've gotten older, I've more and more identified with myself as this sort of my thoughts and my emotions and my awareness, which really is sort of independent of my body, really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've more and more identified with that aspect of me. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense, and I recognize what you're saying. And it happens to me all the time in a purely physical sense I look at what's happening in the basic deterioration of bodies. There's nothing dramatic, nothing unusual.
Right.
But I think, this is like I'm wearing a suit. It's not
that's right.
My actual physical skin at all. It's just I'm like something has been artificially put on me that's very disconnected from the way I feel about it and the effort I put into it and all those issues.
Yeah, well, and also you might have heard me mention in the. In the intro, I'm teaching a class called Writing as a Spiritual Practice, and one of the reasons I do that is because when I'm writing, I'm very much enter this place that it is a kind of alternate reality in that it's entirely beyond anyone else's five senses. I'm existing in a place that can't be seen, measured, touched, known until I choose to express it, and yet I go there, and it's the source of pretty much everything I do. Yet it's beyond the five senses. You can't actually see the thing I'm seeing until I choose to express it. And I spend so much time in relationship to that that's why I think of it as a spiritual practice, which references our sort of non-physical selves. Do you ever have that relationship to it as you're writing?
Well, you know, I'm not sure it's quite the same, but I was thinking just today, actually, I've spent a long day at my desk, and I realized not that I was doing everything entirely to my satisfaction, but just in terms of the way you descend into your imagination as you're writing, and you realize that you're kind of engaged in a way you need to be when you lose all track of who you are and where you are and how you feel and anything that doesn't have to do with the world that you're imagining.
Yes.
And there was a moment today when I was in the midst of a writing when I kind of, you know, suddenly kind of came up out of that and recognized just how far I'd escaped into it, which was, to me, a very good sign. Yeah.
Yes. But don't you find... I started meditating about a year ago, but I'd always listened to people describe meditation, and every time they did, I thought to myself, that's exactly what writing feels like. When it goes well, you know, you go in and you're tired on the one hand, but I do feel a little tired in one way, but invigorated in another, full of life in another, if I've gone in deep and lost track of time and all that.
Exactly. I agree. Yeah.
You know, so you teach, and you were describing teaching Charles Dickens, and so that's a literature class. Do you teach fiction writing also?
I don't currently. I certainly have a lot over the years. About 7 or 8 years ago, I kind of made a conscious, deliberate shift from teaching graduates, MFA graduates, in fiction writing. And I moved into the undergraduate teaching of literature, which I...
Why'd you do that?
I actually kind of felt as though, you know, I taught fiction writing so long, and I actually wrote a book called The Stuff of Fiction, which is, kind of a craft book. And I just heard myself saying the same things in a workshop setting over and over that I'd said so many times, and I just kind of got tired of the pedagogy. I had this opportunity to teach undergraduates, and I like the terms of the teaching, I guess I would say. I like the idea that we're sitting around talking about great books, and the students don't necessarily or at all think of themselves as writers. They're readers.
Yeah.
And I just like that dynamic of two readers talking to each other about a great book instead of a writer talking to an aspiring writer about one's own writing. It's a very different conversation.
It certainly is. And it seems to me if you want to teach aspiring writers, you have to really, I mean, there's all the craft you're going to teach them, and you for sure could have given them, from what I've read and what happens next, all they need to know about that. But in my own experience teaching people, you have to be ready to deal with what's really being dealt with, which is their fear, their egos, their belief in their voice, if that's what's going to come up again and again and again, and you've got to really be wanting to deal with, it seems to me, be wanting to deal with that if you're going to talk to young people about their work. Did that come up for you when you were teaching?
Yeah, absolutely it did. And I think you say it very well, Bill. There's just a whole dimension in that kind of writer-to-writer conversation that, as you say, has nothing to do with craft. And as I always said, and not that I've completely closed the door on teaching graduate fiction writing, but, you know, I always feel that the one thing that can't be taught is the thing that is most essential, which is the imagination.
Yeah. That's right.
You know, you can teach craft until you're blue in the face, and if there isn't a sufficient imagination on the other end of what you're saying, it's not going to work out very well. And all those issues, as you say, of fear and ambition, and I mean ambition in a good sense, and
yep.
ego. Those things are really, really, really very difficult to negotiate sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. You know, so I will take on independent clients some, but I'm more like
uh-huh.
I'm not like an editor, but I call myself a life coach for writers. You know, so it's
uh-huh.
more dealing with that. And but first thing often they'll want me to do is say, read my stuff and tell me if it's any good. And I would say to them, I'm not doing that, because what you
yeah.
want is confidence, and I can't give it to you. I cannot give
yeah.
you confidence. And all the craft in the world is useless without confidence. And confidence is simply like balance. You either find it, but you aren't going to get it from me telling you you're, because you know this, Doug, you could get the best reviews in the world. And we were just talking about a mutual friend of ours, Andre Debuse, who's gotten some fabulous reviews in his life. And he can still suffer with the same questions about himself that theoretically your graduate students could. We all can suffer with that.
No, you're so right. And the balance analogy is a good one, because sometimes you have it more instinctively than at other times.
Yeah.
And, you know, confidence comes and wanes like everything else, and you're right. It doesn't necessarily have to do with the word you're getting from the external world.
That's right.
And if it did rely on that, you'd be in big trouble.
Oh, you'd be screwed, because you live by the sword, you die by the sword. There's a quick story. So Erica Bauermeister wrote School of Essential Ingredients. It was kind of a bestseller for a literary novel, her debut novel. And this taught her about reviews. She got two reviews in big newspapers. And you know how they do with literary novels, when they review them, they do an excerpt to say, as an example of writing. And
right.
two different reviewers chose the same sentence. And one reviewer said, this is an example of what a good writer Ms. Bauermeister is. And the other one said, this is an example of what a bad writer she is, for the same sentence.
Yeah,
and she said to herself, what does it mean? What does it mean?
Well, that would be particularly frustrating,
I'm
sure. Yes.
Oh, it is. So let me ask you this. So here you are. You've published seven books now. I almost lost count. You've got three fiction and three nonfiction plus this collection and a lot of essays and stories.
Right.
What drives you now with the writing? What brings you to the desk? What question, what is the impulse that brings you back to the desk now in your life, at this part in your career?
Well, I suppose that's kind of a two-part answer. I mean, there's that ongoing, always never-ceasing thing that puts you at your desk, which is just something that is just existential, and it just makes you feel, you know, that it's the thing you need to be doing. You know,
yeah.
I can't go very long without writing, and if I do, I start to feel very strange and kind of unsettled,
yep.
unbalanced.
Yep.
Use the
yep.
word again. So there's that isn't dependent on any particular idea or book. And then I think each individual book, in its conception and its execution, has its own reasons for pulling you to the desk. You know, the book we're talking about today was a book probably more than any I've ever written that I felt I had to write for
wow.
reasons that weren't intellectual necessarily.
Right.
It was also for the same reason the hardest book I've ever written.
Oh, really? What made it so
well,
hard?
Just the nature of the material. I mean, you know, we're
sure.
talking about my parents' death and my own impending
yeah.
sense of mortality. I mean, that's pretty it's pretty hard stuff to have to.
Yes,
it's
is.
A hard world to live in day after day after day after day.
And you had to be honest about it. You had to for it to you had to be.
Yeah.
You knew you couldn't just. You couldn't just complain, obviously, but you had to be
right.
honest without being morbid.
Yes, yes. Well,
hopefully without being morbid.
Hopefully without being morbid. And that's the balance I tried to strike. I think what I felt in writing this book were there were a whole lot of things I couldn't be or couldn't do. and one of them was the one you just isolated. I had to be honest. I couldn't be morbid. I couldn't be sentimental. Yeah. Couldn't be mawkish.
No.
All those things, no. I think, given the very nature of the material, would have shown with a particular brightness if I'd fallen victim to them. So I suppose part of the reason it was so hard is because I was so aware of all the things, all the restrictions.
Yeah. But then you have to forget about those and just write and really be able to allow yourself
absolutely.
To feel the stuff deeply to be able to write it.
True. Exactly.
Don't you think? Yeah. But it's a challenge. But it's so worth it. And it must have been very gratifying. I'm finishing a book now that is exactly as you described, that I felt I kind of had to do. And it's been definitely the most challenging book I've ever written, but the most gratifying. And it is, I think it's the best way to write a book, is that feeling of almost having to. I don't know how many of these we get in our lives, but I think it's a great gift when it comes along.
I agree with you, yeah. And, you know, I have to say, looking back at, you know, each book is its own experience, as you know. There are certain things they share in common, but probably more things that distinguish them one from the next. And most of them I have felt for some reason or other that I needed to write. Sometimes the idea was just so compelling, you know, and sometimes the sort of overriding push was unignorable, and that was the case this time around.
Yeah. So I have about 3 minutes left. I'd like you to answer one more question for me, Doug, if you could.
Okay. Sure.
What I'd like you to do is finish this sentence for me. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
If writing has taught me anything, it has taught me what?
That's a hard one to answer spontaneously. I think it's taught me doggedness. It's the only way for me to, you know, to go about the life of writers is to recognize the need to be dogged. And it also makes it, you know, tries to make the distinction between doggedness and madness. You can't, just one thing to sort of stay with it with some reasonable sense of expectation, and where does that line, you know, appear between that and just pure madness? I don't know. I'm glad I don't yet know it anyway.
You haven't crossed that line. Well, I don't think you've crossed it, Doug, in my opinion. Yes, doggedness, out of doubt. Did you feel that you had doggedness before you set off on your real writer's life, or is that something you really learned deeply as a writer?
Oh, I think I had it to some degree. You know, I'm a persistent person and a stubborn person, and those qualities can go either way. They can be assets or liabilities. And I suppose turning them to a profitable end is the best thing you can do with them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Doug, thank you so much for being on my last show of 2014. I hope you have a great holiday season. What's coming up here?
Well, thanks. I wish the same to you.
Okay. Well, thank you. Stay warm there in Boston. And,
I'll try. And thanks so much, Bill.
You're welcome. What Happens Next, Matters of Life and Death by Douglas Bauer. Go out and pick a copy for Christmas time. I will be taking the next 2 weeks off. I'll be back in the beginning of January. Until then, as always, for the next 2 weeks, I want you to write what you love, read what you love, hang around with the people you love. Love, love, love. There's really nothing better that I have ever found. Love is, after all, the organizing principle of the universe. It is. It's true. Heard it here first. Take care, everyone.